Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue our appeals to heaven. We need to continue to learn, pray, and act. We also have to focus. The whole focus is about constitutional compliance. People will not comply to the Constitution until you hold them accountable. So it's all about accountability to that oath, to our obligations in supporting the Constitution, and so forth and so on. And don't forget, if you'd like to actually restore our Electoral College, then you're going to want to support my presidential campaign and run as an elector in 2028. So that means we need to do things, and that means we need to act. So again, learn, pray, act. And welcome back, Tammy. How are you doing?
Thank you. Doing good.
Okay. So we are still in the Pennsylvania debates, and we were going to go into money, and lo and behold, we're in money now. So if you're ready to pick it up. Now, every single one of the states was inflating their own currency. They were just playing shenanigans because there was no standard and there was really no species other than print, script, if that makes sense. There was no real direct tie to any backing or anything. And so let's go ahead and pick this up.
As to the objection that the House of Representatives may be bribed by the Senate, I confess I do not see that bribery is an objection against the system. It is rather an objection against human nature. I'm afraid that bribes in every government may be offered and received. But let me ask of the gentleman who urged this objection to point out where any power is given to bribe under this Constitution. Every species of influence is guarded against as much as possible. Can the Senate procure money to effect such design? All public monies must be disposed of by law, and it is necessary that the House of Representatives originate such law. Before the money can be got out of the Treasury, it must be appropriated by law. If the legislature had the effrontery to set aside £300,000 or £400,000 for this purpose, and the people would tamely suffer it, I grant it might be done, and in Pennsylvania the legislature might do the same, for by a law, conformably to the Constitution, they might divide among themselves what portion of the public money they pleased. I shall just remark, sir, that the objections which have repeatedly been made with regard to the number of representatives being too small, and that they may possibly be made smaller, that the districts are too large and not within the reach of the people, and that the House of Representatives may be bribed by the Senate, come with an uncommon degree of impropriety for those who'd refer us back to the Articles of Confederation. For under these, the representation of this state cannot exceed 7 members and may consist of only 2, and these are wholly without the reach or control of the people. Is there not also greater danger that the majority of such a body might be more easily bribed than the majority of one not only more numerous, but checked by division of 2 or 3 distinct and independent parts? The danger is certainly better guarded against in the proposed system than in any other yet devised.
Okay, so effrontery is if they had the nerve. if the legislature just had the nerve to do this. Anyway, so obviously they're talking about these problems, these perceived problems of both the currency as well as representation and controlling it and so forth. In a way, you could see the anti-federalists were kind of throwing, you know, I'll just say spitballs at the wall, trying to, you know, get them to stick and trying to get everybody to go, oh, that's just nasty. You know, we can't have this. And the real problem is that what they currently had was inadequate, if that makes sense. Because when you actually look at this thing called the Constitution and what it was going to do, it was different. Clearly, it was different. But it actually addressed the problems, which is, you know, kind of what these guys went in and did. They did an excellent job in addressing all of the problems. But that still wasn't good enough, okay? So in the next oration he does, he goes into the president's atul. Go ahead.
If gentlemen will look into this article and read for themselves, they will find that there is no well-grounded reason to suspect the president will be the tool of the Senate. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officers in each of the executive departments upon any subject relative to the duties of their respective offices, and he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States. Must the president, after all, be called the tool of the Senate? I do not mean to insinuate that he has more powers than he ought to have, but merely to declare that they are of such a nature as to place him above expression of contempt. There is another power of no small magnitude entrusted in this officer. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed.
And, you know, that is the one thing that I've been kind of harping on regarding Trump. Trump can actually execute the laws. So the 14th Amendment, Section 3, states that any judge that actually decides to waver against the Constitution and actually try to implement their own version of law, like the concept of due process for an invader, somebody that's here illegally. And so when a judge does that, because clearly the Constitution, even though they may have redefined it, he has the Justice Department. All they have to do is just do the due diligence in going through what the original definitions were. And then when the judge actually says, oh, we've redefined that. And then, bam, slam them out. You basically take them out of office. It's not doing a perp walk, folks. It is emptying that seat and stripping them of the emoluments and the ability to be involved in our government moving forward. Now, the Justice Department can also file crimes or, you know, charges down the road, but isn't it better to get rid of all of these scoundrels than it is to try to come up with a case that will stick? Because the law demands that they be removed.
Yeah, he needs better advisors in this area.
So, anyway. Okay, so the president is a tool of the Senate. And it's interesting because at this point in time, they saw that the power, world power, was not capable of influencing, you know, in the intrigue of nations, bands of nations, and so forth. In other words, the level of corruption and collusion for this global conspiracy of communism, they didn't fathom that. Does that make sense?
Sure, yeah.
They couldn't see that coming. So when they talk about cases, when they look at situations, they go, you know, we think that the things we're going to have to deal with will be problems with the states doing these types of things, and or because the states doing these things would be those drivers of the Senate, right? Because the states control the Senate. But they don't control the Senate today. They're supposed to, but the globalists control the Senate today. And so this is how and why we have seen, you know, this whole perversion and literally indoctrination of imbecilic concepts and principles of the Constitution that actually are not real. They're not realistic at all. So anyway, so we're going to skip down to the next day. And it is now, oh, actually, I think that's evening. That's right. They go into the evening part of the session where Mr. Wilson then dives into some jurisdictions. Okay? And so this is kind of interesting because they do talk a lot in the ratification about in the ratification debates about the trial by jury and how precious this one thing is, that in the concept of our legal system under common law, the verdict of a jury trial cannot be expunged. It cannot be undone. The judges cannot, you know, stop it and do something else. In common law, what the verdict of the jury is supreme. So, go ahead.
Trial by jury forms a large field for investigation, and numerous volumes are written on the subject. Those who are well acquainted with it may employ much time in its discussion. But in a country where its excellences are so well understood, it may not be necessary to be very prolix in pointing them out. For my part, I shall confine myself to a few observations in reply to the objections that have been suggested. The member from Fayette, Mr. Smiley, has labored to infer that under the Articles of Confederation, the Congress possessed no appellate jurisdiction, but this being decided against him by the words of that instrument, by which is granted to Congress the power of establishing courts for receiving and determining finally appeals in all cases of capture, he next attempts a distinction and allows the power of appealing from the decisions of the judges, but not from the verdict of a jury. But this is determined against him also by the practice of the states. For in every instance which has occurred, this power has been claimed by Congress and exercised by the courts of appeals. But what would be the consequence of allowing the doctrine for which he contends? Would it not be in the power of a jury by their verdict to involve the whole Union in a war? They may condemn the property of a neutral or otherwise infringe the law of nations in this case. Ought their verdict to be without refusal? Nothing can be inferred from this to prove that trials by jury were intended to be given up. In Massachusetts and all the eastern states, their causes are tried by juries, though they acknowledge the appellate jurisdiction of Congress.
Yep. And so the interesting thing, because they already covered that the day before, was that in appeals, cases of appeals, that the cases of appeals would be based upon law and fact. They couldn't introduce new evidence. In other words, they could only look at how it was presented. So anyway, so Mr. Smiley speaks, and then and this is one of the very few cases, as a matter of fact, I'll tell you, let me read this big section that with Mr. Smiley says. He says, I said the convention ought to have declared that the legislature should establish the trial by jury by proper regulations. Anyway, I find it interesting that one little comment was injected into this as the anti-federalist comment, because this whole document's really void of this. Anyway, anywho, so now Mr. Wilson dives into the jurisdiction and common law. And as I have said before, common law is so poorly understood. Our legal system was designed so that it was far better for 9 guilty men to go free than for 1 innocent man to go to jail. In other words, the burden should be so hard. You know, it's not about getting everybody in jail. It's not about getting convictions and so forth. The burden should be so hard for the state to actually prove with evidence. We're at a point today where circumstantial evidence convicts a person.
Mm-hmm.
Hearsay can convict a person. And I'm going, you got to be kidding me. So the whole point, now, I've done a presentation on this before, but Britain didn't have a legal identity for basically 2,000 years, well, actually not 2,000, for 1,000 years, because from about 200 AD, when they were basically pulled into the Roman Empire, they kind of adopted civil law and the well, at that point, then the Catholic Roman Catholic Empire started coming out, and civil law and Catholicism and a kind of a theocracy was being laid throughout the Roman Empire. Now, when you look at how things move forward, they adopted the Anglo-Saxon legal system, but they kept on, you know, going down these different reiterations and changing and so forth. I think, I forget when common law was, but common law was declared probably a couple hundred years before the Magna Carta. And common law was a law that was kind of based on, you know, the best implementation of the law. And at this point in time, the law was the law of God, right? Because these were Christian mm-hmm. nations, and they were trying to live God's law and how they interpreted it. So in other words, these... These were actually theocracies of their different doctrines. And so it wasn't until they started actually giving rights and these types of things with the Magna Carta some real credence. You got to remember, when was the Bible first printed for the people to understand the law?
I don't know.
For the Christian nations to understand the law was in the 1500s. So here they were trying to get closer to living God's law, but the laws that they had were being handed to them by this entrusted clergy. Does that make sense? And this was one of those mm-hmm. things that yeah. really started, you know, getting people kind of questioning what the heck's going on, because why do they have the Bible and we don't? Because it was Martin Luther that basically, you know, it was his campaign to put the Bible in everybody's hand. And so...
So the first Bible printed was Gutenberg Bible in 1455.
Okay, the 15th century. And so Martin Luther actually started doing it in the 1500s. And when was the King James Bible created? Since you're Googling. Because that's when Britain decided to break fully away from the Catholic Church and establish their own slice of theocracy.
So, 1611.
There you go. So it was almost a century after the Martin Luther Protestant Reformation, or, you know, a little less than a century. But my point is that at 1600s, that's after Britain had defeated the Spanish Armada, and they were rising to become a global power. Well, they have to have their own religion. They got to have their own, you know, what they believe is the best law of all law, right? So they created the King James Version and so forth. And so in America, we just started, you know, landing and you know, populating and growing commerce and integrating the American colonies into the British system. So, in other words, this was kind of the infancy of the world dominating, you know, force of Britannica or Britain, the little isle that ruled the world. Ironic, isn't it? So, as we look at the 1600s. It wasn't another century plus when Blackstone started actually writing his commentaries on the law. That's how long it took for Britain to evolve into, at that point in time, a legal system under the monarchical crown with a form of representation of the people. And, you know, with the parliament and so forth, and the rule of judges. Now, the judges were appointed by the king. The courts were basically managed and held by the king, because he was the almighty sovereign of creating law, interpreting the law, and depicting the law. And if a judge basically defiled, you know, his orders or did something that he didn't like, it was at his discretion to remove them. Now, there may have been processes and protections, but a tyrant king will do what a tyrant king wants. And so Britain had finally made, you know, there's this saying that you learn when you're a little kid. Oh, they're just making it up as they go along. And that's kind of how Britain was for 2,000 years. Making it up as they go along, trying to make it better, better, better. And then slowly they started getting infiltrated by this new global communist movement, which was later in the late 18th century, 1790s or so, because it was 1776 when the plan was actually concocted of how to move forward in basically ensnaring and entrapping all nations financially and so forth to subdue them into a global governance or global dominated government. So, anywho, so as we kind of look at this jurisdiction common law thing, you got to understand that we really went in another direction with the Constitution, where in Britain, the Bible being the supreme law of the land was the standard. Instead, in America, the supreme law of the land was very limited and defined, and everything else was left to the people. So that at the local governments, you could have your own brand of how you were to govern yourselves, allowing whatever, as long as, and basically the interesting thing was the providence of making sure that it was to be republican in form, not democratic, not monarchical, not, you know, aristocratical. It was to be republican, representation of the people. So, and or the governments. So we're now 250 years later, right?
Mm-hmm.
Almost, because next year, July 4th, July 2nd, will be the 250th anniversary, right? Is my math right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So next year, the 250th anniversary of this nation, and we still don't have our arms around the law. And the reason why we do not have our arms wrapped around the law in understanding it is because ignorance of the law is necessary for tyrants to rule. As a matter of fact, it was Thomas Jefferson that was the one who was kind of noted for ignorance of the law. You know that old saying, ignorance of the law?
No, which one?
Let me see here. I think it was stated like, ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country. This is the citation. This is what Thomas Jefferson said. Ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country. If it were, the laws would lose their effect because it can always be pretended. In other words, oh, well, that's not the law. This is what the law is. In other words, they make up the law.
Or I didn't know, therefore I'm not accountable.
There you go. Well, so if you look at the judges are the great pretenders. Because they're the ones, oh, no, no, that's not how we see it. We see it this way, and therefore this is the law. Because I sit in this seat and have that power to reign what is the law. Because we, the people, have been indoctrinated or inculcated into believing that they have that power.
Right.
And this is how they've been pretending our butts into the situation we're in today. Anyway, okay, so going back to the Pennsylvania debates, jurisdiction and common law. Let's go ahead.
Okay. The power of having appellate jurisdiction as to facts has been insisted upon as proof that the convention intended to give up the trial by jury in civil cases.
Uh-oh, I'm sorry. So I didn't even see this coming. And I should have, but anyway, I need to work on my clairvoyance. But we will be back, folks, after this quick break. My apologies, Tammy. We will be right back after this promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract. And with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, sorry about that. So let me go ahead and read this because I pulled the rug out from underneath you. Anyway, so the power of having appeal of jurisdiction as to facts has been insisted upon as a proof, quote, that the convention intended to give up the trial by jury in civil cases and to introduce the civil law, close quote. Now, that line right there, civil law, is a different form of law altogether from common law. Civil law is where, so if you can't convict somebody of murder, then you can go after them for a civil lawsuit, right? O.J. Simpson.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, because he was acquitted of the crime, they went into civil law where the burden of, you know, of proof is, you know, nothing, and they were able to extract every bit of his property. That's not common law. That is civil law, which thus the case, a civil lawsuit. Does that make sense? See, civil law and under Roman law or civil law, capital C, capital L, civil law, just like common law, capital C, capital L, those are two distinct legal systems. Common law is focused on justice for all, making sure all people receive justice. Civil law is a governmental process of being able to enforce the law. And in so doing, they enforce the law based on their discretion because the judge decides instead of a jury. You do not have a right to trial by jury. And even though in civil law cases they inject a jury, it is not trial by jury, it is a jury trial. The difference, folks, is that a jury trial is controlled by the judge. The judge will tell them what evidence they can consider and what to not consider. And if the judge isn't happy...
That doesn't seem fair.
That is right. So, in other words, the judge controls the process. The law, in common law, controls the process. The jury is held to the law, not to the judge, to the law. What is the law? Okay. And then they have to determine, was the law broken? Was a crime committed? So anyway, this becomes a real...
I mean, because if it's controlled by the judge, then any judge can be paid off.
And they all are. They're all being paid off because... In the framers' days, there may have been judges that actually got paid, but they were probably more of sages. You know, in other words, they were involved in law so long that that's pretty much all they did. But most lawyers were farmers, were clergy. Most all of the framers had taken law. Madison took law. He didn't get his JD. He got an honorary JD from Princeton after, you know, his involvement in the Constitution, all these great things. They said, you know, that guy, we ought to, you know, give him an honorary JD. But for the most part, everybody had, you know, an understanding of law, because in common law, the lawyer was whoever the head of the household was. And you could bring and argue your case in front of a jury instead of, you know, it being this really big money-making case. Now, again, you got to remember that in America, we got started under civil law and under the Roman law, because when England was kind of implementing this new common law, this new system, which was better, brighter, shinier, newer than the old system, the justice system of Britain had been converted from the Roman Catholic Empire civil law system, even though they had common law. As a matter of fact, folks, go look at the definition between common law and civil law at the high level. You'll notice that the judges have this ability of interpretation, where the legislators have the ability of using statutes and so forth to shape the law. But bottom line, in America, under our common law and based on those definitions of the law being supreme, the Bible is not the law, because the Bible can be reprinted, it can be interpreted, and so forth. What is the supreme law of the land is the constitutions. So the question is, when we're looking at government, is the power enumerated? If it's not, then the government is doing something they have no authority to do. Do they have the jurisdiction over this particular case? Does it arise under this constitution? No. So in other words, in our legal system, we should have developed, and these guys actually didn't even see this, they should have been developing a system that allowed all of the justice to be moved away from D.C., because the majority of justice that the people would deal with would be right there in your court, in your county court, or your county halls of justice. It could be somebody's house. It could be the school, because you don't have to spend a lot of money on justice in common law. It's not about these big, huge edifices that, you know, marble and granite and this luster of, you know, beautiful, elegant wood and architecture. The point is that the law may be the foundation, but it is not the dressing of our government. Mm. Hopefully that makes sense. So that the people are no longer encumbered by this ever-changing and evolving legal system to control us more and more. It is cast tightly to those powers delegated. Now, as you start creating criminal laws and those types of things, that's different, you know, because you can actually create laws of decency and those types of things, and you can enforce those laws. And those laws can be challenged if they happen to wander across privileges and immunities that are protected by, you know, the Constitution. And as a matter of fact, if you don't know what is protected by the Constitution, all privileges and immunities. In other words, your right of conscience is not listed in the Constitution. And remember, we've already talked about this, right? If it would be a fool's errand to try to list everything. Just because it's not listed in the Bill of Rights doesn't mean it's not an inalienable right. Parental rights are something that has been established from Adam. And the parental responsibilities, that has all been established. Can the physical government say, you no longer have parental rights, the state is taking control of all families? No, because that right there would violate the Ninth Amendment. Even if they put it in the Constitution, that they amend the Constitution to say that the state will now regulate families and dictate who gets married and where the child, whether the child stays in the family and goes to an, we're talking communism, and they put an amendment into the Constitution that actually says that. Well, the Ninth Amendment actually shuts that down to say no enumeration, as well, I mean, I love doing this, so it's probably far better for me to actually read it than it would be to not. So let me pull up the color-coded Constitution and the Ninth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment states this. The enumeration in the Constitution, let's say they amend the Constitution to control parental rights at the state. New York has done this. So they've amended it, and they say now the state controls the family. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. In other words, they can't take away the rights of the people. They can't take away your parental rights. They can't take away your right of conscience. It may not be listed, and they may actually put it into an enumeration, but if it is a right of the people, then you can't do that. The Ninth Amendment is kind of like that, you know, catch-all, making sure that anything that can be construed as an individual right cannot be trampled on. And New York, I'm telling you, folks, we're seeing this happening today where there is no right that is sacred anymore. They believe that the state can control any aspect of your life. That's where we are. So so my apologies with the rat hole here, but I think it's important to kind of cover these things. So go ahead. And actually, I think I was reading. So let me go on. I have already declared my own opinion on this point and have shown not merely that it is founded on reason and authority. The express declaration of Congress, the Journals of Congress, March 6, 1779, is to the same purpose. They insist upon this power as requisite to preserve the peace of the Union. Certainly, therefore, it ought always to be possessed by the head of the Confederacy. We are told, as an additional proof, that the trial by jury was intended to be given up. Quote, that appeals are unknown to the common law, that the term is a civil law term, and with it the civil law is intended to be introduced, close quote. I confess, I was a good deal surprised at this observation being made, for Blackstone, in the very volume which the honorable member, Mr. Smiley, had in his hand and read us several extracts, has a chapter entitled, quote, of proceeding in the nature of appeals, close quote. And in that chapter says that the principal method of redress for erroneous judgments in the King's Court of Record is by writ of error or to some, quote, court of appeal, close quote. And that's in the third book of Blackstone, 406. Now, it is well known that his book is a commentary upon the common law. Here, then, is a strong refutation of the assertion, quote, that appeals are unknown to the common law. I think these were all the circumstances adduced to show the truth of the assertion that in this Constitution, the trial by jury was intended to be given up by the late convention in framing it. Has the assertion been proved? I say not. And the allegations offered, if they apply to all, apply in a contrary direction. I am glad that this objection has been stated because it was a subject upon which the enemies of this Constitution have much insisted. We have now had an opportunity to investigate it fully, and the result is that there is no foundation for the charge, but it must proceed from ignorance or something worse. Boom. There we go. Now he's going to dive into the militia and talk a bit about the militia. So let's check it out. Go ahead.
Okay. It may be frequently necessary to keep up standing armies in time of peace. The present Congress have experienced the necessity, and 700 troops are just as much a standing army as 70,000. The principle which sustains them is precisely the same.
Okay, so
they may go.
You notice the difference in number, though, right? A standing army is a standing army. 700 or 70,000.
They may go further and raise an army without communicating to the public the purpose for which it is raised. On a particular occasion, they did this. When the commotions existed in Massachusetts, they gave orders for enlisting an additional body of 2,000 men. I believe it is not generally known on what a perilous tenure we held our freedom and independence at that period. The names of internal insurrection were ready to burst out in every quarter. They were formed by the correspondence of state officers, to whom an allusion was made on a former day. And from one end to the other of the continent, we walked on ashes, concealing fire beneath our feet. And ought Congress to be deprived of power to prepare for the defense of safety of our country? Ought they to be restricted from arming until they divulge the motive which induced them to arm? I believe the power of raising and keeping up an army in time of peace is essential to every government. No government can secure its citizens against dangers, internal and external, without possessing it, and sometimes carrying it into execution. I confess it is a power in the exercise of which all wise and moderate governance will be as prudent and forbearing as possible. When we consider the situation of the United States, we must be satisfied that it will be necessary to keep up some troops for the protection of the western frontiers and to secure our interests in the internal navigation of that country. It will be not only necessary, but it will be economical on the great scale. Our enemies, finding us invulnerable, will not attack us, and we shall thus prevent the occasion for larger standing armies. I am now led to consider another charge that is brought against this system. It is said that Congress should not possess the power of calling out the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, nor the President have the command of them when called out for such purposes. I believe any gentleman who possesses military experience will inform you that men without a uniformity of arms, counterments,
and counterments,
discipline, are no more than a mob in a camp, that in the field, instead of assisting, they interfere one with one another. If a soldier drops his musket and his companion, unfurnished with one, takes it up, it is of no service because his cartridges do not fit it. By means of this system, a uniformity of arms and discipline will prevail throughout the United States. I really expected that, for this part of the system, at least the framers of it would have received plaudits instead of censures, as they here discover a strong anxiety to have this body put upon an effective footing, and thereby in a great measure to supersede the necessity of raising or keeping up standing armies. The militia, formed under this system and trained by the several states, will be such a bulwark of internal strength as to prevent the attacks of foreign enemies. I have been told that about the year 1744, an attack was intended by France upon Massachusetts Bay, but was given up on reading the militia law of the province. If a single state could deter an enemy from such attempts, what influence will the proposed arrangements have upon the different powers of Europe? In every point of view, this regulation is calculated to produce good effects. How powerful and respectable must the body of militia appear under general and uniform regulations? How disjointed, weak, and inefficient are they at present? I appeal to military experience for the truth of my observations.
Okay, so here's the observation I have. Ever since the Dick Act of 1903, when the federal government basically took full control over the militia so that the states do not train their own men, the states should have all of the training necessary for anybody that is going to be served in the federal services of, you know, creating the federal army or the federalized militia. Therefore, when you look at the Constitution, all training has to be done by the states individually, and the officer promotions are to be done by the states individually. On top of that, the funding, in other words, the who pays the bill in buying the arms and buying the ammo and paying for these, the training requirements and so forth, that's the federal government's responsibility. Now, in looking at the design, every state was to have a militia capable of protecting itself, which is why the Second Amendment says what it says. That the Second Amendment, let me go back over to it because I don't memorize these things. I guess I should, but there's just so many other things I read. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Just like they said up there, when France was looking at the militia orders for, you know, the framework of the militia in Massachusetts, they chose not to attack because they realized that they were well-regulated, well-organized, and capable of defending themselves. So how important is it that we're capable of defending ourselves? It took over 100 years ago, the federal government said, trust us, we got this. And the states gave up. Actually, they surrendered to an unconstitutional formation of authority. The only way the federal government could have actually executed the Dick Act was by amending the Constitution. That requires an amendment, not just some act passed by Congress and then come along and say, we're going to do this. This is the peril we are in today, folks. Your state should have a militia. The Constitution still demands it. The Dick Act says you're not to have one. You'll have an unorganized. The Dick Act's the one that created the organized and unorganized. And the reality is the Dick Act is not constitutional. And any state that does not right now are in the process of trying to restore this thing called the militia, because bottom line, the federal government's not going to fund it. Why? Because, well, everybody bought off on the fact that they're funding this new system that they have full control over. We're at a point where the states are ripe for any type of intrusion by a military force. I mean, you hear people, conspiracy theorists, talking about Chinese amassing in Mexico and in Canada, and then invading us. We have no militia.
Yeah.
And so what is the mechanism of defending ourselves? Because everybody wants to be protected. Everybody wants that security net. Nobody wants to do what's necessary to maintain their liberties and their security. So, as I say, you know, when we start going down this path of creating standing armies, creating municipal law enforcement, and so forth, you're instantly creating an entity that wants to disarm you. And yeah. Let's remember the fundamental, the truth about the Second Amendment is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. A militia is necessary to the security of a free state. The right to bear arms just means you have a right to just protect yourself. But everybody knows that even though you may have guns, if you're not disciplined, if you're not organized, and you are not, you know, operationally fit, in other words, able to work with everybody throughout the state, your county, and so forth, then they're just going to roll right over you. Yeah, I'll be able to protect myself from my doorstep until they kill me. But we will not be able to repel them. We will not be able to organize a front or anything like that because we're not regulated. We're not disciplined and so forth and so on. So anyway, Mr. McCain now puts in some comments regarding I think the arguments against the Constitution. So this is where we actually get to hear from Mr. McCain. This is towards the very end, if you notice. We're almost there, folks. So yeah. Let's go ahead.
Okay. The arguments against the Constitution are, I think, chiefly these. First, that the elections of the representatives and senators are not frequent enough to ensure responsibility to their constituents. Second, that one representative for 30,000 persons is too few. Third, the Senate have a share in the appointment of certain officers and are to be judges on the impeachment of such officers. This is blending the executive with the legislative and judicial department and is likely to screen the offenders impeached because of the concurrence of a majority of the Senate in their appointment. Fourth, that the Congress may by law deprive the electors of fair choice of their representatives by fixing improper times, places, and modes of election. Fifth, that the power of Congress are too large, particularly in laying internal taxes and excises, because they may lay excessive taxes and leave nothing for the support of the state governments in raising and supporting armies, and that the appropriation of money for that use should not be for so long a term as 2 years. And we have 2 minutes. Okay, and calling forth the militia on necessary occasions, because they may call them from one end of the continent to the other and want only harass them. Besides, they may coerce men to act in the militia, whose conscience are against bearing arms in any case, in making all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, and all the powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States, or in any department or office thereof, and in declaring that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states shall admit shall not be prohibited prior to 1808, nor a tax or duty imposed on such importation exceeding $10 for each person.
Okay, so let me get you to stop here, because we got about a minute left. So these are suggestions that they're milling in the convention or in the ratification debate here, this convention to ratify. If you really look at these other things, indents that I have highlighted, folks, there's no point in necessarily going through these with you, because these are the amendments and the suggestions that they have derived over through the course of these debates. And so, for the most part, I've read these before, we've gone through these before, and I would encourage you to go through. But none of these are stipulations to the Constitution. And we could actually, you know, spend another day or two doing this. But what I'd rather do is tomorrow we'll pick up the next state's debate. And I want to say, I think that's Massachusetts. I believe Massachusetts is next. Well, we'll leave it up to you to be surprised when I tell you what we're covering tomorrow. How's that sound? Thank you so much, Tammy, for joining us.
Yep, you're welcome.
All right. And so with that, what I'll do is I will get these debates posted to replace the existing Pennsylvania ratification debate. So all I'm going to do is just swap them out so that you have new highlights and new stuff that wasn't in the last one. Because I do go through and make words red or what have you. So that way you can garner maybe a little bit more from these. As we always say, we're reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. Please get involved.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.